I will call the next case. The third and final case on our oral argument calendar today is case number A22-1354, State of Minnesota v. Elvis Porte. Counsel are familiar with our rules. Appellant's counsel is ready to go. Yeah, let's reset his time. Counsel, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Davey Axelson, and I represent the appellant, Elvis Porte. Mr. Porte's tampering with a witness conviction must be overturned because he was denied his constitutional right to a unanimous verdict when the judge allowed the jury to pick between two separate factual scenarios involving two different potential victims based on a single comment from Mr. Porte directed at a single person. The district court created this unanimity issue when it sua sponte recommended changing the state's request to...
I think that's what concerns me, is that it was a sua sponte injection by the court. You're not asserting that the state commenced that theory, right? I mean, the charging instrument itself names the woman as the subject of the terroristic threats, right?
That's correct.
And in fact, the state throughout its presentation of evidence relied on that theory.
Until it got to closing argument.
But what in closing argument advanced it to a separate claim? Because that's what you're trying to establish.
Yep. So here the state could have gone full steam ahead on its original charging document, its theory at trial that Mr. Porte had threatened attempted to dissuade Ms. Lutuette, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. From contacting the police. But as soon as the judge brought up this alternative option, the state went full steam ahead with the judge's idea, and I think extensively in closing argument and in rebuttal, specifically told the jury, you don't have to decide who he's threatening here or who he's trying to dissuade here. It can be one or the other, and you don't have to unanimously agree. So we have the initial problem with the judge stepping in, probably in a spot where the judge shouldn't have stepped in, and then the state having the opportunity to say, you know, judge, that's not what I want. Let's keep her name as the named party on the tampering charge, but instead goes along with what the judge wants and then goes full steam ahead in closing argument and tells the jury to do exactly what they can't do is
we
not.
Also have the defense, the appellant in this case, not specifically requesting, okay, I'd hope to avoid saying unanimity. Oh, I did it.
You did it well.
You didn't, I mean, it was argued at first when Judge Chase kind of injected this concept, but there wasn't any specific request that jury instruction be given to the jury, was it?
I think there is. I think when you look at the entire discussion and the dialogue back and forth between the judge, the prosecutor, and defense counsel says that it's a unanimity issue. I don't know if they specifically say that word, but they say the key language of, I think this has to be charged separately for each person. If that's in fact the state's theory, is that there needs to be two separate charges. Now they didn't.
That
make
was
it.
Argued two separate charges, but I didn't see a request by defense counsel for that specific instruction to go to the jurors to make a decision on who in fact was the victim of that terroristic threat.
You know, at the time I wrote the brief, I remember reading it extensively. You may have a better understanding of the record on that. I thought that, I know the state kind of went back and forth about whether the objection had been lodged. I think they indicate that the objection had been lodged, but maybe a second objection had to be made at the time the instruction was given. But I think Litzau and some of the cases cited in my reply brief indicate that once the judge has made a decision and there's been an objection lodged, that's enough to preserve the issue. I think under either standard, we should still win in this case, because once you get to the means versus elements.
What about the Begbie case? And I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. Begbie?
I don't think it matters.
I mean, that pretty much is in accord, at least that's the way I look at it.
I guess I don't agree. I said that in my reply brief, but I'll read.
If you'll elaborate on that, thank
yeah,
you.
I'll for sure. So I think the exact language, and maybe I'm paraphrasing this a little bit, but the exact language of the holding of Begbie is, one, they don't really get into this too extensively. And I think part of the reason is because it's so clear Begbie is threatening both the husband and the wife. But they say, under the circumstances of this particular case, the jury could have reasonably found Begbie intended to terrorize both the husband and the wife. Here, the jury could not have thought that Mr. Porte was attempting to dissuade both Mr. Buford and Ms. Lutuette. And I think
why
that
not?
Because he used the word, and I apologize for using the word, but bitch. He doesn't say bitches. Bitch is a singular word.
Well, that's showing your age, because I understand that that's pretty much an across-the-board label and term for anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it. I'm not saying it's it could be it can be used for either him or her, but it's not for both of them. If he intended both of them, he would have said bitches.
Oh, the plurality.
Plurality. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Not.
I thought you meant that reflected her versus perhaps.
No, I'm saying it could be used for either one. And here, you know, we have the problem of, and I think both the judge acknowledges that potentially he's talking about one or the other, and that the state also thinks that, because that's what they argue to the jury. And that's how we get to the prejudice prong of this, is that once the judge puts that out there and the jury is not instructed correctly and the state runs full steam ahead with it, it's really impossible at this point to say that we know for sure that the jury was only considering, you know, the initial statement or the testimony by Ms. Lutuette, that they weren't also considering Mr. Porte's alternative option, is that he was only talking to Mr. Buford and not to Ms. Lutuette.
So I'm sorry, finished.
I'll be quiet then. Other than the closing argument, was there any other time during the proceedings that the state alluded to it could be either one? Because I understand you've got the charging instrument naming the person, you've got the opening statement by the prosecution that refers to the female victim. Was there anything else during the trial that, the female victim testified, was there anything else until closing?
Well, I would say that Mr. Buford is not especially clear of what's said at that point is clear as Mrs. Lutuette, so that kind of implicates that he's maybe talking to Mr. Buford, and then the state introduces Mr. Porte's body cam or the officer's body cam video of interviewing Mr. Porte that gives this alternative scenario that the judge runs with and that the state runs with. Just want to jump in on, unless Your Honor had a question.
I was just going to ask, is this an the issue?
A what?
Where an the in a person versus the person in the statute? I mean, in terms of unanimity. Prosecutors have gone to great lengths to get the removed and put in the statute. So what, I mean, specific intent, it is a specific intent crime. But it just confirm this for me. My understanding of the record is it was one statement, right? Whoever it was directed to.
Yes.
It was one statement. So because the statute talks about a person, is the crime committed if we don't know who exactly? I mean, there has to be a witness who's being tampered with.
Yeah.
But as long as that can be established, does it? Why does it have to be the same person within the structure of the statute? For that convoluted question.
We discussed this at my moot yesterday, so I'm prepared to answer this question. I think the Winford case talks about how the statute specifically lists a person so that it's okay to just put, and I don't know if it matters if it's a or the, but I think that can't be the end of the analysis. Ultimately, unanimity issues have to come down to elements versus means. Specifically, one of the elements of the crime is the specific intent towards an individual person. You know, on page 399, when they actually give the tampering instruction, that one of the elements is, you know, who did you attempt to dissuade? The second element is, how did you attempt to dissuade them? How you attempt to dissuade them comes under the means analysis. So it doesn't matter if it's a physical attempt to dissuade them or a verbal attempt. The jury doesn't have to unanimously agree on that. And all the cases that we see on unanimity really come down to that, you know, where it doesn't really matter how you commit a certain burglary or maybe that's not a great example, but it doesn't matter for like a criminal sexual conduct case, whether it's force or coercion, the jury doesn't have to unanimously agree. That's the means. That's in the second prong of the test. The first prong and the first element is identity of the person that you're intending. And so I don't think it matters if it's a person or the person. When it's a specific intent, it has to be a specific individual. And that's what differentiates this case from Winford and Bigby and Jefferson. In those cases, there's no question that those defendants are shooting at, assaulting, or threatening more than one person. And I think all those cases kind of stand for that proposition that the prosecutor can make a decision in those cases not to charge multiple counts. And that is perfectly okay based on their charging discretion. But that's because, you know, the defendant gets some benefit too in those situations, which here the defendant said, we don't want that benefit. We want the jury to decide unanimously whether it was him or her and ask for separate charges for that and said that the state had to do that. And so in those other cases, you know, the defendant is getting a benefit when there isn't an objection. There's a reason that the defense attorney wouldn't object, because you wouldn't want, in the burglary case, which I think is Winford, there's three different people who are assaulted in that burglary.
If it's not charged out separately by the state, what difference does it make if the defendant intended to threaten a person? What difference does it make, because the intent to threaten would be there? Why do we have to say which person when they haven't charged anyone else?
I think it, again, comes down to the elements versus means analysis. And because one of the elements, the first element, is the identity of the person, that's an important component of the charging instrument. And without the specific intent towards that specific individual, we fail on the elements test of the unanimity instructions. Unless the court has additional questions.
I do.
Okay,
Can you help me understand, in only 3 minutes or less, the distinction between acts and means? And I guess this has troubled me in the past, but it seems like if the jury need not unanimously agree on a single means, if there could be multiple means, it seems any time that there's two different means of committing a crime, those are inherently two different acts. I mean, I don't know, you know, so it's hard to square that with the rule which you, in your brief, take from Stempf, that the jury must unanimously agree on a single act. But if there's two different acts that are different means, if that's permitted, why is it rational to require a single act?
I would say that's why, at least for me, I always think of it in the terms of elements versus means. And I think the cases do also discuss that distinction, because I think you do potentially run into the problem, and you would run into the problem here in some of these other cases of, you know, a physical threat versus a verbal threat are different acts.
Sounds like you're changing the rule.
What's that?
It sounds like you're changing the rule, then, the rule of Stempf.
No, I think, I don't have this at the tip of my tongue, unfortunately, but I think the cases do talk about elements, you know, versus means. It's not just acts, because I think you do run into the problem of, you know, again, it is two different acts, whether you threaten somebody, you know, verbally or physically, but those are been considered means under most of the cases that we look at.
And then another question is simply whether Stempf is still good law in light of subsequent Supreme Court opinions such as Crow's Breast, Isle, and Pendleton, which seem to say things such as the point about means and other things. It seems like Stempf has been cited by this court many times. It's never been cited by the Supreme Court in any way. But it seems like it has a very strict test, and only shortly thereafter in Crow's Breast, the Supreme Court cited the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Shad, which was much broader and more permissive. And they followed that up with similar language in Isle. In addition to my question, is Stempf still good law? Maybe I would challenge you perhaps to tell me which Supreme Court case was violated here by the district court, or which Supreme Court case supports your arguments of an error here. Compound question, I understand.
Yeah, let me see if I can digest that in 45 seconds.
I'll give you more than 45 seconds
okay.
If you want.
First, I would say that, yes, Stempf is still good law. I think that the cases that you talk about, again, are, you know, and I'm familiar with all of them, but I can't name the exact facts. But again, Those really discuss different means of committing an offense, and I think at least one of them discusses, like, in a when you're charged with multiple acts of child abuse that lead to a murder, it doesn't really matter that the jury has to unanimously agree which act of child abuse that you committed, because those are means to commit the greater offense. I think Infante talks about single behavioral incident, and I think, you know, despite the fact that we have some unity of time and you know, an action here, the defining characteristic here is the fact that it's two different people, and that there's a question about the two different people of who he's potentially threatening. And I think that's what makes this case fall into line with the cases that say that this is acts and not means, or elements versus means. Thank you. Unless I'll save my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Right. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Axelson. Mr. Hasse, you may come forward for your encore performance.
May it please the court, counsel. Again, I'm Jim Haas, and I represent the state of Minnesota. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney. I'd like to follow up on Judge Siegel's comments about whether this is an or the type of situation. And I just go back to the statute, 609.498, about witness tampering. And the provision here under subparagraph is, by means of force or threats of injury to any person or property, intentionally coerces or attempts to coerce a person who is or may become a witness, to testify falsely at any trial, proceeding, or inquiry authorized by law. I think that's one of the ones. Let's see. To go back and make sure that's the run. But in all of these various versions of it, maybe it's the intent to dissuade. Intentionally prevents to dissuade or attempts by means of force of injury to any person or property. All these versions refer to, you know, threat to any person and then a person. And that's what Judge Chase talked about in his statement. And I quote that part of that colloquy in my brief, and I think it's important. And Judge Chase talks about what he refers to as the absurdity of having to do two separate counts to address one single statement that we believe is directed at one particular person, the woman. But Mr. Buford was certainly in the immediate blast radius of that statement and could have been influenced by it. And as, you know, without repeating the term, he could have been referring to either or both of them. Hey, because remember the facts. Mr. Buford had been assaulted by Mr. Porte, and they were approached by a pedestrian, this woman. And Buford says to the pedestrian so many words, I've been assaulted, call the police. So there's an initiation here of a request to call the police. And Mr. Porte is alleged to have said something to the effect of, you know, if you call the police, I'll F you up, and use the pejorative bitch. And I think the state obviously assumed that that was the woman he was referring to. But Judge Chase, you know, points out that, well, you know, he could have been talking to both of them. And he says, and I think this is an accurate statement of law, and I think this really is a legal question. Judge Chase says, so I'm inclined to modify the instruction. The jury instructions, the jigs, just put in a thing where they suggest you put in the person's name. But that's not what the statute says. The statute just says a person. So I would submit that Judge Chase's jury instructions, and I think the judge has the right to step in and say, hey, I'm kind of in charge of these instructions here. I'm going to weigh in on it. He says, so I'm inclined to modify the instruction to make the first element, the defendant intentionally attempted to prevent or dissuade a person from providing information to law enforcement authorities. And that implies that the jurors could disagree on whether it was Buford or Lautet. But as long as they agree that a person was the intended recipient, the crime has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I just respectfully submit to you that is an accurate and correct statement of the law. And I think this really is just an application of, that's it. That's the statement that the court is reviewing of the district court. And if he's wrong on that, then you should reverse it. But I think
it needs to be a precedential determination one way or the other if we buy into that argument that the jig as it stands is incorrect.
I didn't say that necessarily the jury instruction was incorrect, but what they do is they generally put in the bracket that says fill in the name of the intended, you know, the victim or whatever. I think that's the gist of it there. And I'm not saying that's wrong. You could certainly do it that way. But I don't know that you have to. And I think in some circumstance like this, I think following the statute was correct. Stemp is distinguishable. To answer Judge Johnson's question, I would suggest to you that Stemp has been distinguished to the point of effectively being abrogated. It's repeatedly cited, but almost always distinguished. Is it good law? I don't know, go so far as to say it's bad law, but the distinction in Stemp, as the court's aware, is we have two distinctly different parcels of drugs. There's drugs found in Stemp's vehicle, in which I understand he's a passenger, and then there's drugs found in a building where he works. I mean, imagine there's drugs found in Stemp's home and then drugs in a storage unit 30 miles away. You could be factually innocent of one, but guilty of the other.
Now, in Stemp, as you know, the defense counsel did specifically ask for that unanimous decision. In your briefing, you seem to indicate that you're not worried about whether or not this was specifically requested at the time the jury was read its instructions. You're trying to say that that should not be our issue, that there's enough of an inference that this was adequately raised?
I'm not going to stand on formality with respect to the standard of review. I think, you know, obviously Judge Chase brought this up for the first time, and so counsel may have been caught a little bit unawares, but I think their intent was clear that, you know, maybe they didn't say the words unanimity, but they disagreed with Judge Chase as far as whether the state could charge two counts. I don't know. I think I stated in my brief, the court may disagree with me, and I'll leave that up to you. Frankly, I'd like a ruling as a matter of law under the abuse of discretion standard. Maybe it wasn't properly objected to, but I guess that's not the main thrust of what I came here to talk about, I guess. I'll leave that standard review to the court. You can look at the record and see if there was a proper objection. Clearly, the defense counsel disagreed with Judge Chase about this paragraph I just read. I think that's inferred. And whether they made a formal objection or not, and whether that triggers or not plain error, I'll leave that to the court, I guess. But I came prepared to just to talk about the substantive application of the law. But, you know, in Stemp, there are two separate distinct acts, two separate and distinct parcels of drugs that could have been possessed by him or not. There could be clear factual innocence of one and not the other. Here we have a single unitary act, a single unitary threat in a single instant. It took seconds to say it, and these two people were right next to him. I just think that the circumstances in this case are, as a matter of law, indistinguishable from this court's decision in Begbie, where, and there, you know, remember in Begbie, he was talking to the wife on the phone. The husband wasn't there, and he was making these threats only to the wife. Unbeknownst to him, she was recording it, but he was only talking to her. He may have made statements to the effect that I'll kill both of you, or there's, you know, that could be implied, but he didn't know that necessarily that it would go on to the husband. He couldn't say that for sure. Of course, it did, and they both, in their own way, felt threatened by these statements. But this court found that it just didn't matter, that it's sufficient that all the jurors unanimously agreed on their ultimate conclusion that Begbie was guilty of the crime charged, even though they may not have agreed upon exactly which victim Begbie had intended to terrorize. That's the statement in that published case, and I think that squarely addresses the circumstances that we have here. And I think appellant's attempts to distinguish Begbie fall short under these facts. So I don't know. That's really what I came here to say. Unless the court has any questions, I would remit the balance of my time and just respectfully ask the court to affirm the conviction. But a precedential decision on a matter like that might be helpful for us, because we do repeatedly cite to Stemp in these kinds of cases, and I think that might give clarity to the district court. So I'd respectfully ask that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Hussey. Mr. Axelson, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just quickly on and one point, unless you have additional questions, but again, just repeating that almost every criminal statute lists a person or any person. You have to specifically add a person's name in as the victim in every individual case. So the fact that the judge used a person because that's in the criminal statute, I don't think really is the analysis that this court should look at. It should look, I don't think that would abrogate the means versus elements analysis or means versus facts analysis. And other than that, I don't have any additional arguments. I maybe just to add on to his point is that I would also ask for a published decision on this point. I think that we need to know whether or not if you make an individual threat and it's towards one person and you list two different people,
there's always bystanders though. And that's, you know, I think about precedential natures of opinions and I keep coming back to this is so case specific because if you're in a courtroom and somebody makes a threat, everybody hears it, you know, as compared to, do you get what I'm getting at? That's why I'm not sure it has the legs for any kind of precedent setting case.
Yeah, ultimately, that's for you to decide. I mean, I think of the Jefferson.
With encouragement from the attorneys.
Yeah, I mean, in Jefferson, there's two different people in the alleyway, and he's shooting both in their general direction. But I think there it makes more sense why that would just be an individual act, and the prosecutor decides for whatever reason not to charge both counts. I think, again, a lot of this stuff comes down to prosecutor discretion about how many counts they want to charge. Sometimes the defense attorney isn't going to say anything about unanimity because it's to their client's advantage. Here, it wasn't necessarily to Mr. Porte's advantage, but his attorney wanted to make sure that that the jury ultimately decided who he was threatening, if he was threatening somebody at all. So thank you for your time, and safe travels back to the cities.
Thank you, Mr.
Axelson. And you as well, Mr. Axelson.
They'll try not to pass you.
Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its written opinion within 90 days. And that is our final oral argument for the day, so we are now adjourned. Thank you.